Welcome to Season 5 of the Fight Science Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are further expanding our knowledge by speaking to experts in the fields of physiology, psychology, nutrition, strength and conditioning, and mindset training. We'll be speaking to the coaches and practitioners who do this every day, and to the researchers and academics who are at the forefront of the sciences. Today, our guest is again, Dr. Reid Real. For those of you that missed our first episode together, Reid is the who's who in the combat sports nutrition world. He is one of the most foremost published researchers in the area and is currently the performance nutrition manager at the UFC Performance Institute, Shanghai. I wanted to get Reid back on the podcast to discuss his recent experience spending 5 weeks managing the nutrition of all the athletes on UFC Fight Island and discuss some burning topics that are hot in the world of combat sports nutrition right now. There's a lot of great info to get through, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live. So back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. It's been a little while since we've done this, but what a time to do it. And what a person to have on. We have our return guest, Dr. Reid Real, coming back on for the second time. Dr. Reid, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Geordie. Obviously, I didn't do too terrible a job the first time that you got me back for a second one. So now that you're a global superstar, it's my absolute honor to be featured on your podcast.
You know, it's funny. I was on the bike and I was riding. Was it on Saturday? I think it was. And I actually listened to our podcast and I listened to it back. And I thought, you know what? Reid's actually not too bad. He actually knows his stuff. And I thought, I wish I listened to this back more. Yeah, no, it's good to have you back on because there's been a lot that's happened. I think we spoke last time was probably like 18 months ago or around about there. Was it around about a year, 18 months or so?
On the podcast, yeah. Yeah, it was. I was in China then. So, yeah, it couldn't have been more than 18 months, but it was around the time when I first started. So, yeah, between a year and 18 months.
Yeah, that's right, because we had all those troubles with the China war. And I remember we tried to set up the podcast for about 3 weeks straight and we couldn't get it going. Yeah. But we got it back on. So anyway, Reid, let's get into it. How's it going? First, that's the first thing I want to ask you. You're in China. You've obviously been there for a while, but we've just got out of this COVID period. And I guess COVID for a lot of people was a bit of a weird time, but probably none more so than you. You probably had one of the weirder times during COVID.
Yeah, I've got a good COVID story. And we talked about this off air a little bit, but it's kind of interesting. So I'll talk about it now for your audience. But basically, January 22nd, I left China for Chinese New Year, which is like the biggest holiday here. So it's like Christmas in Australia or whatever. And at that stage, there was no real talk of COVID. I remember we had a conversation in the office. One of our operations directors, she said like, oh, there's this little virus in Wuhan. Maybe it's like SARS or something. And they were saying at that stage, they said, like, it's no big deal, but they're not letting people leave Wuhan. And if visitors come from outside of Wuhan and come to Wuhan, the people who invite them get in trouble. And we didn't think anything of it. Everyone just had a bit of a chuckle and whatever. We're like, you know, crazy China. And anyway, so then January 22nd, I jumped on a plane and went to Chiang Mai in Thailand to train at Team Quest and a bit of a holiday and eat Thai food. And I thought I was going for 1 week. And probably 3 days after I left, you know, it started to get more serious and people are, you know, it wasn't just Wuhan, it was other cities in China and they're saying maybe it's spreading and all this sort of stuff. And so we had a few like emergency meetings with work. And they said, and at that stage, all of the foreign staff, all of the managers and directors at the PI in Shanghai had left, gone back to Australia or to Canada or the UK or wherever they were from. And they just told everyone, the higher up said, everyone just don't go back to China yet. Let's just wait and see what happens. And then, so I stayed in Chiang Mai another week and then it was like, all right, this thing's getting worse. Like everybody stay outside of China. And basically, long story short, what happened was I ended up in Chiang Mai for about 3 weeks. And then I went to see a friend and train in Bangkok. I was in Bangkok for maybe another 3 weeks. Then they flew me to Auckland for the Hooker and Felder card in February. So I was in Auckland and then went to, and then I seen you in Auckland. And then we went to Las Vegas to the head office, to the PI there. And then I was in Vegas for maybe 3 or 4 weeks for the Zhang Wei Li fight. And JJ, that was, you know, awesome place to be for that. And then I went to Florida. I used to live in Florida, so I went to check on my house that I have there and see a few friends. And then I was going to go to Australia. I was going to go see my family, see my mum and that in Australia. And the day before I was going to fly, the Australian government went crazy with all the lockdowns and travel restrictions. So I thought, fuck that. I don't want to go back to Australia and deal with this. So I went to Bali and I thought, I'll go hang out in Bali for a couple of weeks, because at that stage, the corona stuff had just started to take off in the States, and China had put the US on a high risk list. So they weren't letting people come straight from the US into China. But what they said was, if you get outside the US for 14 days, then you can come back to China. So I went to Bali and training there at our Bali MMA and whatnot. And I was in Bali, and then on day 9 of 14, China closed its border completely to all foreigners. So then I ended up living in Bali for 6 months, which was actually pretty awesome, because I got to train every day and hang out by the beach and eat cheap Indonesian food and life was not bad, and I was still getting paid, thank God. And I know that, you know, that time for a lot of people wasn't real good. So I was very fortunate for that. And yeah, I was in Bali for 6 months and then flew to Fight Island and was there for 5 weeks and got to be there for the Khabib fight, which was awesome. And obviously caught up with you in Abu Dhabi again. And then finally returned to China probably late October, I think October 28th, and did my two weeks quarantine. So prior to that point, I kind of avoided all the lockdowns and the I measure it by how much did I get to train. And I got to train jiu-jitsu almost every day throughout that whole time. So I was very fortunate. And it was a strange, interesting, good, but bittersweet, because the rest of the world was going through some bullshit. But really interesting chapter in the life of Reed.
Yeah, it is. I remember, I think I saw you in December. Were you in Vegas in December? I might have seen you there for when we were there with Alex. Or I definitely saw you maybe there. And then New Zealand, we caught up. We were in Auckland. And then when we went back with Israel in March, I remember seeing you with the guys there. And then I remember coming back from that fight. And when I walked through the airport coming back home, that's when I was like, oh, man, this like corona stuff's getting a bit serious. And pretty much the day after I got back is when they shut it off. So it's when, and that's when you must have went on your 6 month little adventure. We got to Fight Island, and I guess that's where I saw you next, is where we flew to Abu Dhabi, and you would have come straight from Bali. You went straight from Bali to Abu Dhabi, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, via Jakarta, via Indonesia, but yeah, straight from Indonesia to Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, like I said, not a bad spot to stay to, Bali, get to train. You're training at Bali MMA, is that right?
Yeah, I was. When I first arrived, I trained at Bali MMA, and then they shut down for a month, actually, so I trained at another place, Rituals, with Justin Saddell. I trained there for a little bit, then went back to Bali MMA.
Yeah, not too bad to spend your COVID lockdown there, hey? But let's get into Fight Island, because Reed, you were kind of manning the ship. You and Charles were over there in Abu Dhabi. I've spoken to Chef Mario about what he thought. Fight Island, I'd like to hear what you thought about it as a whole. I guess we'll get into the details, but I guess what was it like? What was it like being part of one of the most historic, I would even say moments in MMA, I'd say historic events in all of sport?
Yeah, I would agree. It's super impressive. Like, I was just blown away, number one, by like the human race in the world, like where we are now with just like technology and contact tracing and testing and all that. But it's like, man, when I was a kid, I could never imagine this sort of thing. Like the ability to actually like control a virus, right? Like this thing's in the air and you can't see it and it spreads like crazy. And it's just, it's an impressive logistical challenge. Like, you know, like you said, aside from the sport and aside from the MMA, but like, you know, each event, what they got, like 26 athletes and then staff and whatever. So let's say they're flying, I don't know, like, and UFC had some kind of overlap. So they had operations staff that would maybe stay 2 weeks and then leave and whatever. And, you know, there's probably 1,000 operations staff or whatever, but then just the athletes and teams and coaches and whatever, that's probably another 100 or so. But let's say there's 150 or 200 people flying in and out every week, and they're, you know, quarantining, getting tested pre and post and all this, and you've got these overlapping events and everything. Is just it's really impressive how they handled the whole thing and that they actually were successful in doing it, because you know, it wasn't spreading. I think there was a few cases where people arrived and then tested positive and they just kept them isolated and then got them out of there and it didn't spread. So you know, it's like UFC, Abu Dhabi, and you've seen how good like the hotel staff were there. It was really impressive the way that they pulled it off. And it was funny because everyone was kind of hating on UFC, like, oh, they don't care about people, they care about his money and this sort of stuff. But then after seeing it, I'm like, man, they did a really good job in the way that they were able to obviously trying to make money and run these events, but doing everything they needed to keep it safe and COVID free. Like, it's, I mean, that's probably the safest spot you could be in the world at that time, right? Like, I think I did 18 COVID tests while I was there.
Yeah, no, it was crazy. Hey, it was crazy how well they managed everything and even how methodical everything was. And like, we were coming from Australia and New Zealand, and just every step of the process was just such, so well planned. And yeah, and like you said, like with the contract tracing, with everything, with the testing, you go in there and you go in the quarantine for 2 days, and then you come out and you got to wear your mask everywhere, and you can only go this area and that area. It was really impressive. It was crazy to see. It's crazy to see. And just the scale that they do it on, it kind of makes you appreciate just how big the UFC has gotten.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. 100% agree.
For those of guys who are listening, when we're talking about the fight week, so these guys are coming in. You, like you said, you're getting all the international athletes around the world, all the guys that can't fight in America because of COVID, they're coming to fight Ireland. A lot of these countries as well are going through their own lockdowns. They're going through their own gym problems. They may not be able to train. They may not be able to diet. They've got all these issues. Their weight may or may not be good. They're coming in, and then their first point of contact for all their nutritional needs is you and Charles. And you did this for 5 weeks back to back, and you guys did a really good job. Like, I'm pretty, you guys had like an insanely good strike rate for considering everything you guys were dealing with, all these people coming in. What was that like? Talk us through. What was it like managing these fight weeks for all these guys coming in around the world? They're just rocking up. You don't have that much info. Here they are. You've got to get them on weight. What's that like?
Yeah, it's hectic. And like you said, there's like everyone's got their problems in their home environment. And because of the nature of the virus and whatnot, it's it was a lot of last minute fight matchups and last minute contracts getting signed and whatever. So a lot of people are not where they need to be. So they're much larger than they should be at that point in time. And then, that in and of itself, when you do a normal fight week, even for a normal dietitian who works with fighters, you normally get a phone call 4 weeks before their fight and they're 20% above their weight division. And like that in and of itself is problematic. We're getting guys 5 days before they make weight that are 15% above their weight division, and they're stuck in a hotel room for the first 2 days, and they don't speak English. And, you know, they've got all these weird OCD relationships with food, and they don't want to eat the broccoli or the chicken breast and whatever. So it was like a normal fight week on steroids, of course. It was in some sense, like it was perhaps more difficult with more moving pieces, but I won't say moving pieces, but in another sense, it was kind of more predictable and controlled because of the nature of the quarantine situation. So it's like, you know, you didn't have to guess where the athletes were going to be, and you didn't have to worry about them eating other food and whatever, because it's like there was no supermarkets in the safe zone. There's no convenience stores. They're trapped in that room for the first 2 days. And it wasn't a case of where normally it's like we're trying to negotiate with fighters to see whether they want to engage with the service or not. Like, we were tasked with the responsibility of handling the nutrition for every fighter on every card. And so except for like some of the heavyweights, which, you know, didn't have to make weight and didn't want the service, although half of them still did want the service, but the others that didn't would eat at the hotel restaurants. You know, we were handling like, you know, 95% of athletes on every card. So that was difficult. It was, and the thing that really made it work, and you can probably testify to this, was just the hotel staff. Like, normally we get minimal involvement from the hotel. They give us a kitchen, and so Chef Mario gets to work in the kitchen. We interface with the athletes and prescribe, food quantities and whatever to Mario. And then another thing was the time zones. But what the W Hotel did for us was they were like, you know, they had kitchen staff helping Mario prepare the food. They were asking us ahead of time, what sort of food you want? How should we do this cooking? They were letting us use their in-room dining service. So one of the biggest problems was because most of the events were broadcast and conducted on US time, Abu Dhabi local time meant that they were fighting at like 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m. And because of that, obviously you work backwards from the fight. You should be training around the time that you're going to be fighting. So athletes are going to be up at all hours. And because they're training at weird hours, they're going to be eating at weird hours. And of course, not every athlete does this properly. So 24 hours a day, there would be somebody training and somebody wanting to eat. And And so it was kind of chaos from that sense. But the hotel staff, again, letting us use their in-room dining services made coordinating meal deliveries and stuff easier than it would have been otherwise. But, it was certainly a huge logistical challenge. But in some sense, it was a little bit more controlled because it was quite predictable because of the nature of the quarantines and all the systems that had to happen. It was 35 or 40 days in a row of, 5 hours sleep a night. And of course, I can't take credit or sole credit for the nutrition stuff because, number one, Charles was there for the first few weeks helping me, and I was assisting him. And also the systems that he had set up for me to kind of carry on with, and also at the previous Fight Island that they had kind of set up and, gone through a lot of the trial and error, made my experience there a lot kind of more straightforward than it otherwise would have been.
Yeah, can we go through them? Because, like you say, it sounds very chaotic, but there are a lot of external factors that you can control and even internal factors within these systems. Can you talk us through, well, what are these systems? When someone comes in and they rock up the Fight Island and I sit down in front of you and I go, hey, Reed, I'm hungry and I need to lose X percent of weight, what happens to me?
I mean, basically, and you and I probably talked about this on the last podcast, and I'm sure you've spoken ad nauseum with all your guests, we've got kind of like fairly agreed upon methods, whether it's like, low carbohydrate, low fiber, low sodium, low fluid at the end and whatever. And calories are maybe somewhat irrelevant for most people, but people cutting a lot of weight, you should probably drop the calories anyway. So we've kind of got this, method that we're going to follow. And then how that works in reality in implementing it is fighters arrive at Fight Island. We try and contact them as early as possible. Check-in day is on Tuesday for the Friday weigh-in. So at the latest, we're going to speak to an athlete on Tuesday. But it's in our interest, if I care about my job and want fighters to not miss weight, to try and make contact with the fighters earlier. So because Charles and the guys at the PI in Vegas and yourself, had so much exposure to these fighters, we try and use whatever networks we already have to contact the fighters as soon as they arrive or even before they arrive. So if there's someone flying from the US, we want to know, like, all right, you're going to arrive on Friday and do your quarantine. How heavy are you? And we know whether they're a red flag or not. People who aren't red flags will leave it until check-in day. People who are heavier than what we want to start to get onto it earlier. But that first interface is obviously how heavy are you? That's like the primary thing, right? And then getting some context around those weights. So, if somebody's 10% above their weight division, but they're still eating a shitload of carbs and fiber and still drinking a lot, then that's one thing. If they're 10% above their weight division and they've haven't done anything but look at lettuce for the past 2 weeks, then they're probably already somewhat depleted. So, getting context around that weight. And then, of course, general kind of dietetic nutrition stuff, food allergies, food preferences, blah, blah, blah. Once we collect all that information, we start to think about the intervention or what their weight cut diet plan for that week is going to look like. And again, it's kind of pretty stock standard in terms of, low fiber, low carbohydrate at appropriate times and whatnot. And then it's just kind of coordinating with the kitchen staff to provide those nutrient targets in a way that lines up with the athlete's food preferences. So again, it's like most of the fighters would get out of quarantine on like the Monday or the Tuesday for check-in, and we would start the food delivery then. But for those that were deemed to be high risk, we could start, again, thanks so much for the hotel staff, we could start delivering them more appropriate specific meals even while they were in quarantine. And then even backing up a little bit, Charles and the guys in Vegas and Clint had last time kind of put together a quarantine menu. So for the athletes, as they arrived, even before we had any eyes on them or any contact with them, the athletes would be on a quarantine menu, which is like, low calorie, low carb, low salt type thing, but, plenty of fiber and whatnot. And then like carbs on the side, so that hopefully, and of course we know this isn't the case, if the athlete has a brain, they can decide whether they need the carbs or not. So that was a way of kind of setting them up for success before we even had contact with them. And then once we had contact with them, we would fine tune it and deliver it from there. And then of course, once we're out of quarantine, daily interfacing with athletes, getting weights on the daily, having conversations with people, continually coordinating with the kitchen. And then obviously on weigh-in day is a whole nother thing, or and the day before weigh-in day, helping athletes with weight cuts and, you know, how to work the portable sauna, how to turn on a bath, what a kettle looks like, you know, all these sort of things. And then on weigh-in day, being at the arena for when the athletes step off the scales to provide the recovery food. So, yeah, I think that kind of answers your question, but if there's anything else, let me know.
Hey guys, a quick interruption to the podcast to keep you updated on what is happening with our latest product, TrainAid Hydration. For everyone that has been following along, you know that TrainAid Hydration is an oral rehydration formula that we have formulated alongside some of the world's leading hydration experts in order to keep you optimally hydrated no matter what you are doing. We are dropping it in less than 3 weeks, and if you want to keep up to date with the latest, then be sure to follow TrainAid on Instagram and TrainAid Performance on Facebook. All right, back to the podcast.
No, I'm laughing because I spent a good 10 minutes trying to figure out that portable sauna. I was putting some, put water in here, playing with the things because I knew one of the guys I was with wanted to use it. And I knew he was going to say to me, how do I do it? And if I didn't know straight off the bat, he would have given me this look. And I've seen that look before. And it's not good.
What am I paying you?
Yeah, exactly right. But hey, Reed, you mentioned the red flags there when these guys are coming in and you obviously flag these guys. What are the parameters? What are the parameters that deem these guys as red flags? And do you guys put them in zones like red, orange, green or whatever? And then do you track those parameters throughout the week as well?
Yeah, of course. So general flags were like anyone who rocks up to check in greater than 8% above their weight division is a kind of immediate flag right there. Greater than 10% is a extreme flag. Because this is essentially 3 days out, right? But then, so they're just kind of like blanket ways to, start to categorize people. But then as you start to speak to the athlete, if you've got a guy who's had 30 fights and he's telling you he always checks in at this weight and he's never missed weight, and we look at his history and that's indeed the case, he's probably less of a flag, right? We would still highlight it and be mindful and make sure to stay on top of it and stay in constant contact. But certainly weight making history is a big one. And then aside from the history, the context around the weight, again, if they're tempered, like some of the guys that we have in China who, are quite lean, always eating, plenty of carbs, always well nourished, 10% for those guys is not the same as 10% for somebody who's already cut carbs and not eating fiber. So, they're kind of the cutoffs that we use is 8% is a flag, above 10% is a red flag, and then getting context around that. But again, you get guys who check in at 7% above their weight division, and then you start to speak to maybe some of the Brazilian athletes where there's a history of water tapering, where they're progressively decreasing water for 10 days before a fight. So somebody's 8% or 7% above their weight division 3 days out, but they're only drinking 500 ml of water per day. Although that's not a classic red flag, it is something for us to watch.
What are the parameters that you're tracking, or what are red flags throughout fight week that's making you go, oh crap, we might be in a bit of a pickle here?
Yeah, I mean, certainly weight is a primary thing. So just a morning fasted weight. And that was another thing that fucked everything up, was because of the time zones, and people are sleeping at weird hours. It's what do we consider the morning fasted weight? It seems like such a minuscule thing, but it confounds a lot of your, flags and thresholds and cutoffs when people aren't going to bed until 6 a.m. And then they're waking up at 2 p.m. Is it the 2 p.m. weight? It probably should be, but if people's bodies are used to kind of digesting food and their kidneys working in a certain way on a certain time zone, does that kind of throw some of that stuff out the window? I'm not sure. And then the fact that the weigh-in was in the afternoon versus in the morning, that kind of, rejigs it all as well. The things that we're tracking is number one is that morning fasted weight, and then just continuing to get context around everything. So if somebody stops drinking water 2 days before because that's their method they've used in the past, then you obviously take that into context when you're looking at their weights. And then another thing is people not losing weight despite following the plan. So it's two things might be going on. One is they're already depleted. And so you're not going to expect further weight loss. If somebody's already, been low fiber for 6 days, then you would be thinking a lower percentage above their weight division is a bigger flag than it normally would be. Did I say that right? I think I did. And then another one is, the water's always a big one. Like if people are not, and sometimes people even go up between days, and that's probably because they're already dehydrated and they're, you know, the water's kind of bouncing up and down. Whereas ideally, you know, the water would be high until, you know, pick your mark, whether it's 24 or 36 hours or whatever. Like if people are already starting to cut water and the weight's going up, that despite they say they're following your plan and you know, they're eating no carbs and no fiber, but their weight's going up, then, you know, they're probably already pretty dehydrated. So just continuing to collect context around those weight measurements is pretty much what we're tracking.
Yeah. And what do you guys do? Say if someone is one of these red flaggers and they're showing these red flags throughout the week, or they get to that endpoint, what do you do? What's the process when they're heavy? What do you do when it comes the weigh-in time?
You don't be there when they're going to do it because you don't want to be held responsible. No, you, I mean, kind of, but, I mean, what else can you do, right? It's like you do everything that we know is going to work. And then, like, in my opinion, and I think the evidence would suggest, like a calorie deficit doesn't help that much in those last few days, but that's the only other thing you can throw at it, right? Is like, you know, drop the calories, drop the protein, but how much muscle are they going to lose in 3 days? Like probably nothing, but all you can do is really cut the calories and maybe, you know, cut the water a little bit earlier than you otherwise would. Think about the food weight on that last day. Like normally I would want people eating, you know, right up until weighing or at least a few hours or at least like the dinner for the night before, even if it's something small. But, you know, when it's disaster stations, they can probably do 24 hours with no food at all. You can keep encouraging the heat acclimation, things like this. And we kind of had the luxury. I mean, it's not a luxury, but the fact that we were dealing with so many athletes and the logistics around the weigh-in and everything, we kind of couldn't be there for most of the athletes, like right at that end point. Which in one sense, given our role, like we're not as, for most athletes, involved to the same extent that you are, where we're not literally holding their hands in the bathtub, you know, for every fighter. So we're able to have that distance because there's a certain point where, particularly in our role compared to your role, where you're working, you know, one-on-one contracted with these fighters, like we're there to help guide and provide assistance and to be like an impartial, you know, resource for all of the athletes in a similar fashion. So all we can do is kind of continue to provide best practice evidence, best practice evidence-based, nutrition support, and then also educate and also, you know, God forbid, but be telling coaches and teams, you know, maybe you got to think about thinking more about this guy's health than about him making weight at a certain stage. So, but when it comes down to that kind of pointy end of it all, we're generally not there, and particularly on Fight Island, just because of the scale of how many fighters we're working with and our precise role there.
Yeah, that's something that's always blown my mind, right? And like you said, like I have the luxury that I work with these guys one-on-one, and I work with them all year. And for pretty much all my clients now, we've done so many camps together. So like you said, if these guys are coming in heavy, I know exactly what's going to happen to their body. I know when we get to that last little bath, but I know to the minute exactly how long we need to spend in that tub. I know how long we need to spend in the wraps. I know what to feed them after and everything else. And I sit back and look at what you guys are doing, and you've got literally hundreds of athletes that you've probably never even had contact with. And then you're just making it work. You're putting them into this system, and it's like, okay, I expect your body to respond this way. And if it doesn't, well, okay, well, I don't know a lot more about you, so let's just make it work as it is. So it's impressive on that sense.
Yeah. Charles and that did a real good job setting up these systems and operationalizing the research out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, Reed, I want to ask you, because you are one of the very few rare unicorns that have gone, and I'll give you the title of pracademic. You've gone from being a complete research, quote-unquote, nerd, and you've gone and you're really hands-on. You're really in the trenches with these guys in the fight weeks. Like you said, you're taking them all through this process. And now I deal with a lot of academics and research, and I have the utmost highest respect at a lot of like my mentors and close colleagues, and they've taught me so much. But often I do find there is that distance. There is that distance where you can put all of this information and it's like, well, wait until you try it. Wait until you're there and during a fight week and all the stress and everything else that's going on in fight week, you know, there's a few other things you got to consider. How has your opinion on the whole making weight, especially cutting weight in that fight week, how has it changed since you've been doing this a lot more hands-on with so many athletes?
Yeah, I'll answer your question, but first I'll take issue with the pracademic title. I don't know how you phrase it, but I would like to think I'm similar to yourself in a sense of being an athlete first and then going to the academic and now coming back out. Because I remember, like, I dropped out of high school and started, like, with all the bro science and bodybuilding and then got into jiu-jitsu and cutting weight stupid ways myself. And, like, a dumb story is I remember after one weigh-in for a jiu-jitsu comment, we used to do, like, morning weigh-ins, not immediately before, and just dumb shit, like, I'm like, all right, I need to have such a certain amount of carbs and electrolytes. So I've got the Gatorade in the powder bucket. And I'm like, well, you know, here's 600 ml of water. Why do I need to drink like three of them? Why can't I just put the same amount of Gatorade from three drinks into one drink and then I'll get it down quicker and I'll have all the energy and stuff. And then, you know, get going and making a mess of the toilet like 20 minutes before my match. And so I guess like having those experiences in the beginning and then going down the academic route and then coming back out, it kind of gives you a certain perspective on it all. That I think, like you said, a lot of the pure academics don't have. But certainly after being here in China, and then the Abu Dhabi experience was really good because that was like 5 weeks back to back. Like I think I counted it one day. It was like, let's say it was 120 athletes or something, or 100. Anyway, it was over 100 that we did in those 5 weeks of time, 5 week period of time. So that was quite good. But how have I changed over the years? So two things. One I'm more kind of certain about, and then another I've flexed a lot on. So the one that from doing this for years that I've become more confident in suggesting is fighters maintaining their chronic body composition in an appropriate state. So it's like, you know, a lot of coaches and a lot of athletes like to fluctuate a lot in between fights. You get really big and fat in between fights and then do the big diet, the big fight camp, which essentially becomes a fat camp. Whereas some athletes and, you know, a lot of our guys in China, not a lot, but several of the guys in our academy, you know, they might sit 10 to 12% above their weight division year round. And it's not necessarily because they're trying, they're just fortunately geared that way genetically. But what that allows them is to not be in that calorie deficit for, you know, 6, 8, 12 weeks trying to bring their weight down. They can just eat, fuel the machine, train their asses off, and then do that final weight cut at the end, which, you know, is 7 to 10 days or, you know, however you do it. So I think after going through the, and that's my point as well. And then like with Fight Island, with all these last minute fights, and there was a few people that fought like 2 or 3 weeks apart, you know, people who are 20% above their weight division, 25% above their weight division, you can't take these fights on short notice. Or you can, and you're going to either not make weight, hurt yourself, or have a terrible performance. So I think, and I feel like, I don't know what you've experienced. I know your guys are pretty reasonable, but I think there's a bit of a changing in the culture for MMA athletes to be more professional and like more, you know, 52-week athletes instead of, you know, 12-week athletes. And I think this is a really good thing because, you know, it's like all the top sports, pick your athlete, you know, Michael Jordan, LeBron James, whoever, you know, they're absolute professionals where they're working around the clock and doing everything they can to help themselves. And for MMA and combat sport athletes, part of that is maintaining your body composition and body mass in reasonable limits that allows you to have productive training camps. And I don't think, although this has been like a weird situation with the COVID and the Fight Island and that, I don't think it's going to go back to the way it was where fights are going to be given much longer notice. I think this, you know, put your hand up if you're ready to fight type sort of environment is kind of here to stay because it's working. And there's, if you're not willing to take the fight, there's somebody else that will. And particularly with more and more MMA athletes just coming up in the world. And what was really cool in Fight Island was to see so many athletes from non-traditional MMA countries, like the big three are like US, Brazil and Russia. And now it's like you've got a few coming out of Australia and New Zealand and even like the UK. But, you know, so many of these European nations and African nations and different Asian nations started to produce fighters. So I think there's like the pool's getting bigger, the depth is getting greater. And along with that is going to come this high level of professionalism, and professionalism in a weight category sport entails, you know, maintaining your body weight within a appropriate range. So that's one thing that I've kind of learned and reaffirmed throughout the years and throughout that Fight Island process. And then, so the thing that I probably have changed my mind on is just, and seeing at Fight Island especially, is just like, it never ceases to amaze me the outliers that exist within the human race and the variability in people's physiology. Like, if we're saying, you know, we don't want people to cut greater than 4 to 5% on that last day in sweat, right? And if we say that most people can lose 1% of their body mass per week while maintaining muscle mass, and then you start to do this in reality, you know, there's all these nice formulas, but everything, and you know, what is it? 7,700 calories is a kilo of fat. Well, you know, throw that one out the window. And all this sort of stuff. But like, everything that we have these numbers for is based off research, which generally looks at means, you know, changes between groups and the average between the group. But there's always outliers, of course. So some people are above and below the line. Pretty much everything, not everything, my scientist brain keeps stopping me from, you know, speaking in absolutes. A lot of things in biology exist on a bell curve. And so if we say that these kind of goalposts are and thresholds and, you know, cutoffs for red flags and orange flags and how much can someone cut and, you know, when is it dangerous? If we're coming up with these numbers, that represents the middle of that bell curve. So if we say you shouldn't cut more than 5% of your body weight on that last day, well, I'm obviously not going to mention names, but I seen one guy in Fight Island that was doing like 3.5%, super lean guy, and you know, had over 20 fights. You would assume that he knows how to cut weight. His body's got a lot of water on it. He struggled. It took him all day, you know, 6 to 8 hours of running, sauna, bath, wraps to try and get that weight down, 3.5%. And at a smaller guy, and you know, the smaller guys, like I'm talking bantamweight, can normally do a bit more. And so you've got that end of the bell curve. But then you've also got the other end. You've got guys that are just like, they wake up 8% above their weight division with 3 hours to go before weighing, and they just do a few cycles in the bath and they're on weight. And so something that I've changed my mind on, and it's funny because you always want to be conservative because you want to protect the athlete's health and safety, and you also want to be successful in your job. So it pays to be conservative because there's less risk, less health risk, and there's less risk of the person missing weight. But you know, some people can just do crazy things, and some people's physiology is geared up in a certain way that enables them to, you know, be an outlier on the extreme end of the bell curve. So something that I've started to change my mind on and trying to do a better job of recognizing is, you know, the individuality of particularly the dehydration side of it, but everything in general. And, you know, again, like you working one-on-one with your guys and having that really detailed, in-depth relationship allows that. And then, you know, with our academy here in Shanghai, we're starting to develop that as well. Like, I've got 25 athletes. We're up to 40. We've scaled back to 25 that we work with on the daily, and I'm starting to collect some of that data. Maybe you're more, and I don't speak Chinese, or EDNDN, but so like my level of understanding is probably not the same as yours with your guys, but we're starting to develop that. But then on the other extreme is the fight week, where you meet a guy 3 days before he's going to make weight, where you know nothing about him. But you know, how do you balance all these things? Because you know, it's just that they're very, very interesting questions and concepts. Because on the one hand, it's like, yep, be healthy, protect your health. You know, we don't want people cutting crazy amounts of weight. But I thought about it like this, and I had this conversation with someone else the other day, right? Some people are huge, tall freaks. Some people are 7'6". And you don't say, oh, it's not fair for this guy to play basketball because he's 7'6". You say, get that guy in the NBA. You know what I mean? Whereas like some people can like sweat 8% of their body weight without it phasing them. And so do you say this guy can't cut 8% because, you know, that's your golden rule? So, and I don't necessarily know what the answer with all this stuff is, but that's something that is starting to really interest me is how do we measure and predict the variability? And then how do you ethically implement that into your practice? Because that's a whole another thing to consider.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question, because like you said, anyone who does this or I don't know, thinks about doing this, and once you start practicing, and if you
start practicing with a lot of people, that's the first thing you'll notice is the bell curve exists. Like that's not like some random thing that someone just came up with. And that's a concept that well and truly exists, because like you said, there are athletes, and I have probably a handful of athletes who I know can cut pretty safely 10% water weight on the day of their weigh-ins. And I am pretty stringent with testing with these guys. Like, we do metabolic markers, we get doctors looking at these guys, and whether or not we're walking on a tightrope and maybe something will happen and they'll fall off, that's definitely a possibility. From the outset and the numbers that we can collect, it would seem that their body can just do it. Whereas, like you said, there's other guys where I've had 2 or 3% and I've been sitting there scratching my head going, what the heck? Like, you lose more in a training session, yet we get here and we've done everything right, yet something in your body has just said, no, this isn't happening. So that was going to be my next question, Reed, is how do you see this progressing? Because obviously, like you said, there is a change in culture, and I've seen that. There's a change in how people talk about making weight. I think by the nature of the sport, by the fact that there's more researchers, I think the fact the UFCPI, what you guys are doing, and the fight weeks, and you guys are elevating it, putting it in the public eye. I think the fact that people are jumping between weight divisions, like say Israel is jumping middleweight champ, and then I'll pretty confidently say he'll probably go up to light heavyweight and become light heavyweight champ, and he won't cut any weight to do that. And then there's other guys that do that, and you know, what's the Dagestani crazy dude, Kamzmit, or whatever his name is, like he jumps between the weight divisions and he does pretty well. So it's like, if there's all these other factors that are involved in us giving these guys guidance and saying, hey, look, you can do this, but how do we go about that? How do we go about that? Is it something that you do in the research? Is it something that you do with education? Or what are your thoughts around that?
Like, knowing your athletes is the number one thing, right? And that's what you do a really good job with. I feel like I'm writing a testimonial for your website here, Jordy.
Yeah, don't get me in trouble with certain bodies.
But, yeah, I mean, I know that's what you do a really good job with. And and again, with the PI, like, that's the first thing we look at is somebody's history in terms of how true is this flag that we've identified. And that's what we're building with our academy as well. So it's like, first of all, it's like, know your athlete. And then how do you implement it? Like, I think you owe it to the athletes, the sport, and yourself to be conservative in the beginning. I think that's just, it makes perfect sense, right? Until you know better, you're on the side of caution. Yeah, and then how, like, where is it going, and what are we going to do with it all? I don't exactly know, because I mean, do you really want to push everyone to cut as much weight as they possibly can? Probably not. Like, maybe it's like, I've been thinking, toying with the idea of like RPEs around the weight cut, right? And maybe you say, like, you know, nobody really rates a training session at 10, and if you do, that's a hard training session. If we're doing the 1 to 10 scale, if it's 6 to 20, obviously it's something else. But that was a little nerd brain fart there. But but like with weight cutting, so with a hard training session, maybe it's you're too sore to train the next day. With a bad weight cut, maybe it's you're dead. So maybe you're not trying to, the goal's never to get them to a 10. Maybe the goal is get someone to a 6 or something. And so, yeah. Yeah, I don't know. It's interesting question where it's all going. And, you know, it's certainly not the bigger the better. We know that. Like, the only time when you would be having someone push the limit is when they're really undersized for the weight division above and you think they can safely do it. Yeah, difficult question.
And the reason I ask it, and it is a difficult question, because it's a difficult question because there's no right answer, right? There's really not a lot of answers to pull on. But the reason I ask it is because you're 100% right when you said there is a change in culture. And I think a lot of that is to do with popularity. It's like people like yourself, like growing up, putting out good information, like Carl and James putting out great information, Mark Germain, people like that. And I'm not sure if you saw, but like I wrote an article the other weekend about a very unfortunate event that happened with an athlete here in Australia where she got some pretty ill advice. And during her weight cut, an athlete that we used to work with, we assessed her and said, no, that's not an appropriate weight cut. And she went off with another team. And the reason I ask is because I'm not entirely convinced that it's conveyed enough that, yeah, maybe being conservative is best. And maybe that's just the cultures I kick around it. It's that maybe you and I, we both think the same and think, yeah, you know what, even if you can do 10%, let's aim for 7%, let's aim for 6%, and probably the less the better. But I think it's important to hammer home to people that, you know, just because you can make it doesn't mean you should. And I'm wondering, is that something that you found like in your practice with these guys? And I guess the ultimate reason I'm asking is because you see so many people in this sport and they're cutting a lot of weight and they're doing it with this idea that, oh, you know, I'm going to be better for it. I'm going to be getting a better result. And you know what? My body can get down there. And I think from the seat that I sit in with the athletes I've worked with and being pretty one-on-one and knowing their body, I'm not entirely convinced. I think, again, there's some outliers. I definitely have one athlete who competes at a very high level who I think should probably cut more weight and go in bigger. But for the most part, I don't know if that's a thing that entirely exists. But I'd like to know your thoughts. What's your thoughts on it? What are your thoughts around, you know, going in there and just cutting as much weight so we can get this perceived advantage?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you have to say that the jury is still out on the relevance of weight and size in terms of competitive success, just because that's, you know, if you're being scientifically honest, you know, we probably don't know either way. There's some studies that say in some sports there's a benefit and others that say in other sports there's not a benefit. There was the one study that looked at the weight regains in, was it UFC or Bellator in California?
Both, and they showed both, yeah.
It was both. And they've shown you know, no difference between winners and losers. Mind you, every single athlete was fighting one to two, sometimes three weight divisions above what they weighed in at. So is that evidence that weight cutting doesn't help? I think it's maybe the contrary. But this is my take on it. It's funny. Like, I don't think there's a 100% scientifically accurate answer, but I am pretty confident to state this. If you don't cut weight, let's say for MMA, or let's say for MMA or a sport with like a day before weigh-in, like in professional boxing, even if it's grappling, but you get a 24-hour weigh-in, right? If you don't cut weight when there's an opportunity to do so and take advantage of the weight regain opportunity, then you're silly because your opponent will very likely be doing it. A large weight differential probably puts you at a disadvantage. So if somebody's 10% bigger than somebody else, they've probably got an advantage. This is like the whole reason why weight divisions exist. But the difference between like 1 to 2 to 3%, or maybe even up to 5%, I think is probably somewhat irrelevant. Like whether you're regaining 9% or regaining 12%, I think as long as, like, I always want guys to get back around 10%. If they're 8 to 12%, I'm like, okay, we've done our job. If they get back in there 6% above their weight division, I start to think, what did we do wrong? What can we do better next time? And if they have a big regain, you're kind of like, oh, look at this guy. So there's that. And then on top of all that, obviously, you know, no matter how much bigger than Marcelo Garcia I am, I'm never going to beat him because he's just better than me at jiu-jitsu. So there's that, but we're assuming that kind of skills are equitable, and so we're talking about the physiology and the body comp and that. But on top of what I said around the you want to cut enough and regain enough to not give your own opponent a significant size advantage, but the actual nuanced difference between the two competitors in terms of like single digit and certainly under 5% probably doesn't matter, but it's also probably dependent somewhat on fighting style. Like if you're Israel Adesanya and you're going to dance around and pick guys apart, the weight probably doesn't matter so much. But if you've got a heavy grinding wrestling grappling style, maybe the weight accounts for more. That's kind of where I'm at with it. Cut and regain somewhere around 10%. Big is certainly not better, particularly if you have to hurt yourself to get down there. And the nuanced differences, so aside from the mean average differences, probably depend on your specific fighting style or combat sport in question.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. I think if your opponent's going to do it, I think you probably should do it, because I think anyone who, grappling especially, and I think the open weight class, if you go to like any jiu-jitsu or the absolute weight class, is an absolute testament to that. And you would have done it. Like, I remember the first few times I jumped in absolute and just having someone in a locked arm bar or a locked triangle only to get picked up and thrown, and just, okay, maybe technique doesn't work as well. But I think not giving them too much, but I think you're absolutely right that there's probably a point where that becomes redundant, where it's like, okay, if it's 2 or 3, 4%, and maybe that's in relation to their power, to strength, or, you know, size to strength or whatever. And maybe there's going to be research that's going to assess that. And we say, you know, up until this point, it probably is irrelevant. So for all of this style of combat sports where it falls within that, then probably don't do it. But, you know, for all these sports above it, combat sports like mixed martial arts or judo or whatever, then yeah, probably would. I think fighting style, yeah, I agree, it's a big one. And you see it, like you see guys like, you know, like Nate Diaz and you know, Robbie Lawler, guys that just like walk you down and punch you down. I think if you're going to be in that real slugfest, then anyone who's been punched by someone who's even 5% heavier than you, you feel a difference. But then he's like you said, someone like Israel, I've seen Israel pick guys apart who are twice his size and half his size. It doesn't matter. Like Israel's going to pick them apart. So
if fighter A hits fighter B 100 times and fighter B never hits fighter A, like it doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah, exactly right. I was going to ask you, Reed, I'm going to ask you, and you're going to put on your world leading, because you probably are and you won't say it, but I'll say it. But say you're the world leading athletic pracademic in the world in this area. Do you think cutting weight is going to go away anytime soon? Or I'll add to this question, do you think it should?
You threw a spanner in the works there with the last one, but is it going to go away? 100% not. And should it? I mean, if you somehow find out a way how to stop it, then yes, but it's impossible. I mean, I shouldn't say impossible, but I'm 99% sure they're never going to solve it. I mean, artificial intelligence and the, what do they call that? The, it's like that point in human evolution.
Oh, yeah, where it's singularity or whatever.
Well, once the singularity's here and the AI robots and the, you know, whatever, figure it out, then there's probably a way. But I mean, everything you do, they will find some way, right? So, yeah. I don't think it's going to go away, and it would be nice if you could remove that stress. But I mean, just move the weigh-in to right before the fight. Like, I don't think it's a problem in jiu-jitsu. Like, it's people cut a little bit of weight, they won't cut a lot of weight. And you know, to our point before, the differences that you end up in jiu-jitsu, well, it never ends up being like a significant size advantage at the time of the competition. But whatever advantages they get seem to be trumped by the technique. Like, I don't think it's, maybe a guy's stronger, but it's not because he's bigger in a jiu-jitsu comp where they weigh him in 20 minutes before that they win. But they're not going to do that for professional combat sports because of all the, business and logistics and other priorities.
Well, I'm not going to chew you too much more, Reed, but there's one last question that I do want to ask you. Again, I'm going to keep saying this. I'm only saying this because when I rolled with Reed and Fight Arnie, he gave me a bit of a spanking. As the leading athletic pracademic, where do you see the field of combat sports nutrition going? Obviously, you've probably been in this, you know, one of the longest of the active, you know, people who are doing this as a full-time job. You've probably been in this longer than most. You've seen it develop over the years. Where do you see it going in, say, the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to see it just kind of, it's a funny thing. I was going to say, I'd like to see it just reach the same status as other sports, you know, like endurance sports and all of this have taken the limelight in terms of, you know, the way it's taught at universities and textbooks and all this sort of stuff. But I think combat sports offers a unique opportunity for examining human physiology and nutritional biochemistry and all that, you know, even aside from the fact that of what's happening, but just the, because it's kind of like they're kind of like strength and power sports. They're kind of like team sports in terms of, you know, heavily glycolytic demanding sports and all this. Plus you've got like the weight cutting and all that. I just think it's super interesting. So it'd be good to see combat sports just kind of, you know, the same way that the sports themselves are rising. It'll be just great to see combat sports nutrition kind of get to the same level as all these other sports in terms of the permeation into kind of mainstream academic and nutrition areas. It'd be good to see more athletes take on board, and I guess that will come with it. But yeah, there seems to be, it's funny because like you talked about it before with the being conservative, and it's like, we're conservative, you and I, we're conservative compared to old school coaches, but compared to a normal dietitian, we've lost our minds.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like in terms of what we're recommending. But it's the fact that normal dietitians think that way that the athletes aren't listening to them. So, I think if it permeates academia and kind of standard nutrition education courses and stuff a lot better, then you'll kind of increase the understanding of the kind of well-intentioned clinical and general nutrition cohorts, and that along with that will come more buy-in from the athletes, and the whole process will get safer, and hopefully we don't see any more disaster stories.
Yeah, fingers crossed, eh? All right, Reid, I won't take up too much more of your time, but one last thing. I know this is notoriously difficult to get across the China wall, but if guys want to get in contact with you, if they're listening to this, they go, hey, Reid's a smart cookie, I need to chat to him. What's the best way for him to do that?
I've got an Instagram that I barely use, but I'm getting better at using.
You are getting way. I've noticed that. You've been posting a lot more lately. It's good.
I've been trying, but it's difficult. It takes me like 40 minutes to write a post, and when I try and reshare, it's like you can't reshare on Instagram. So I downloaded the repost app, and then that gives me problems, and it's very difficult. But some woman told me the other day actually that 35-year-old men and 35 years and older men cannot handle an Instagram account. So which seems to be true, but they can contact me on Instagram at is that what you say? Hashtag at Reid Real. And I'll give a plug for my book, Jordan, and I'll put a let me put a discount code for your listeners. So www.combatsportsnutrition.com. And I'll put a 20% off or something, and you can post it on your Instagram, which has a lot more followers than I do.
TFD20, let's do it. Hey, and if everyone's listening, because I always get asked that question, and I've got a list of recommended readings on my website, but Reid's book was actually one of the very first books that I read and went, wow, this is actually really good. So yeah, TFD20, let's do that. And it's Combat Sports Nutrition ebook. Is that the website they've got to go to?
Yes. Yeah, and it's and I recently updated it too, and I'm going to constantly do that. I just like whenever it's it's a really simple book, right? It's just like basic nutrition knowledge and biochemistry. It's like science explained in a kind of dumbed down way. It's as fancy as it needs to be, but as simple as it can be for athletes and coaches to just kind of get their head around what's important and what's not. Because you and I know it. It's fairly simple nutrition, but there's a lot of bullshit on the internet and spoken in gyms, and so it just kind of clears the air with a lot of that stuff, and I'll constantly add to it throughout the years. And whenever my our minds never really change on it, but they do evolve and kind of get more nuanced and refined, so I keep updating that.
Yeah absolutely. Yeah, if anyone's listening, go to that, because I refer a lot of clients and a lot of coaches and teams I work with before we get deep into doing anything. I say, hey, go have a read of this just so you have an understanding of what we're going to be doing. So if you're listening, let's do it. TFD 20, Reid. Let's make it happen. 20% off. And it's just before Christmas. What excuse do you have? What excuse do you have not to buy it? All right, Reid. Well, mate, thanks so much again. I know you're busy, Az, so I appreciate you taking the time to come on. But, mate, no doubt I'll chat to you soon.
Yes. Thank you very much, Jordan. Always a pleasure. And keep up the good work.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. There's a lot of smart people in this field, but there is only one Dr. Reid Real. He truly is leading the way in both research and practice. After recording this, he even bumped up that discount code to 40%. So if you want to read his book, which I highly encourage you do, then go to combatsportsnutritionebook.com and put in TFD40 at checkout for that 40% discount. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.